coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. You find us on the anniversary of Brexit 1776.
Wow.
our Independence Day. And in light of our Independence Day over here, Stu, Cole had a great idea for a show tonight. And Cole, what was that idea?
Well, I got to thinking about, you know me, I love a good play on words, and the term independent comic or indie comics, we never really talked heavily about the booms and busts of the indies, and I thought, what better time than as close as possible to the American Independence Day to talk about independence, being the plural of the independent comic.
That's right. And we have brushed against, abutted, been adjacent to, and talked a little bit about independent comics throughout the history of this show. But
they were ships that passed in the night.
They really were. They were Jack and Rose.
And we smile when we say it's all right.
Oh.
We're still here. It's just that we're out of sight.
Just as long as you don't cross the Cetera Maginot line, we'll be all right.
Okay.
Don't you do it.
I'll leave it with just Manilowing you for now.
Yeah. But yeah, so we're going to talk about independent comics tonight. And we are blessed once again with a wonderful, beautiful guest with a certain special expertise in this world. And that is none other than Weldon Adams. Weldon. Welcome back. He blew our minds during the during our time period era story arc with the now I can't get it out of my head secret societies of Egypt, and we have returned.
Yes,
now
indeed.
To discuss independent comics. How are you, sir?
I'm doing dandy.
Dandy. I love
it. Well, you truly became the pharaoh of comics on the last one, so we had to come back to you because not only the myriad ways your life has touched the comic industry, but you've got more than a passing knowledge of a lot of what we're going to be talking about.
So, esoterica.
if you were a superhero, that's what I would call you. Is that okay? Can I call
yeah.
you? It's a little bit on the feminine side. Esoterica.
Well, you put a captain or a
yes.
Something like Count Esoterica.
Oh,
I like
that's
that.
It.
Count
that's it.
As honorifics go, that's one of the best.
That might be what we might induct you into the Muggerville 7 as Count Esoterica.
It's so true.
We don't have a Doctor Strange character yet, so you might
there
be
you
that character now. Just careful what you wish for. So I kind of want to start here because I have two luminaries in the field that have worked in the industry and in and around what we'll talk about tonight is a lot of the independent books, and then the meteor that killed the dinosaurs that was the direct market crash that brought a lot of independent comic publishers down, as well as the internet age, and then the after effect of the Kickstarter market. But what do you guys define as an independent comic? Because I have some ideas and I've had arguments, so I'm curious.
That is an important aspect. So Weldon, where do you
well, I've given this
possible.
A lot of thought. Yeah, I've actually given this a lot of thought in the past. I've always been very, very fascinated with the, to use the term, more esoteric publishers out there, all the way back to the Golden Age. There were some fantastic small press publishers in the 60s that were a flash in the pan. But the term indie comics, to me, has always had a very specific term and meaning, even in the alternative press. Because to be independent, I've always asked the question, what are they independent from? What makes them independent?
Right.
And of course, the obvious answer is they're basically not Marvel and not DC. So the only time that becomes important is after the point in history at which Marvel and DC dominated the market absolutely. And of course, that happened in the late 60s. So it, through the 70s on up, you see the rise of independence. And especially in the 80s, that's when the term started being used, and that's when it really gelled into a thing.
Yeah.
When it was cool to be independent.
That's right.
And I think you bring up a very important point there, is by the 80s, and especially the 90s, as the rise of the indie began, that notion of being independent of the big two was very much – you know, rode on the idea, well, it's not Marvel or DC, or in many cases, this is the sort of thing they would never publish. And in many ways, it was also a product of initially just individuals who went out and like self-published a comic. One of the more striking cases is, of course, a couple of lads who threw every penny they had into creating Mirage comics and unwittingly unleashed a phenomenon that will never go away.
Definition of indie comic right there.
Because they were beholden to none.
Yeah, and by the same token, not just any publisher would I really consider independent. If you go to 1975, to be exactly precise, there was a publisher that popped up out of nowhere, published a ton of books, all in 1975. Everything they published happened in 1 year. No title they published went over 4 issues. Sounds like an indie publisher, doesn't it? Except it was Seaboard Atlas. And every single book they did looked exactly like a Marvel comic.
That's awesome.
So in my book, not an indie, because they weren't trying to be independent. They were trying to be Marvel so hard, they had the same trade dressing on their covers.
Ah. Well, what were some of the titles they published? I may have seen them without ever realizing what I was seeing.
Tiger Man, they published The Brute. They published Blazing Combat Tales, something like that. The Destructor was one of the only ones that made 4 issues. That one was co-created with Wally Wood. Some of their books were really fun, and I liked them quite a bit. Larry Lieber was their editor-in-chief, and of course, as you know, that's Stan Lee's brother, so he'd worked for Marvel for quite a while. And a lot of the talent, they were hiring actual Marvel talent. They did everything they could to be Marvel. And in fact, they're called Atlas Seaboard or Seaboard Atlas to differentiate them, but on the books, it said Atlas. Atlas was the name Marvel published with in the 50s.
You know, I think I may have had an Atlas book. I'll have to look at that. It was something like either Morlock or Warlock 2001.
Morlock 2001.
Good night. I actually did know. That was I found one issue on the – I am relieved, however, to discover that it probably didn't go very far, which is I don't feel terrible that I found the one on a 7-Eleven rack and loved it and never could find another one after.
The good news is if you want to complete the set, it doesn't take that long.
That's so true.
There were three. One of the standout books from the line was The Scorpion, and the first two issues were by Howard Chaykin and are two of the finest comics he's ever done. They are fantastic. And for the third issue, he left. The character was basically Dominic Chan. He created the character there, and then he took that character somewhere else, and it became Dominic Chan or Dominic Fortune or whatever his name was. He's used that character. Yeah,
I have.
He's used that character several times. That's the origin of that character.
That is amazing. Yeah. And I am familiar with the character as well. I remember seeing that in the day.
Yeah.
There's another character named Devil Slayer who turned up in their line and has since turned up in Marvel Comics as Demon Slayer. Or maybe I have that backwards. But yeah, that's another character that started there.
Wow. Yeah, here's my stance, and you know, take it or leave it, because I've had this argument. You can't high road me on this argument. I've had it 1,000 times, but there are real independent comic creators out there. A lot of those comic creators have since gone on to have really big roles in the current comic industry. Look at Palmiotti and Quesada, who made Ash, and now what?
Right.
Quesada's is he at EIC at Marvel, or he's close if he's not? You know, Palmiotti's still out there just making comics, doing what he loves. But
I believe Quesada's a co-publisher at Marvel now.
Okay. My catch. which is the next to Dark Horse. I have a problem with calling Dark Horse and Image and Wildstorm and Independent Comics. I have an issue with that.
Well, especially Dark Horse and Image, because they began as indies and then became these massive corporate entities.
But they Dark Horse is a little different, because Dark Horse did definitely start as indies. Dark Horse was one of the first publishing houses that gave creators the right to their own work and really made a environment conducive to the creator to come in and work with them. But Image started from, what, five or six guys that went out, and they were almost completely corporatized, is not a word, but we're going to go with it, immediately, to the point where if I can see Rob Liefeld in a Lee Jeans commercial, you aren't an independent publisher anymore, all right? You aren't the Elon Musk of comic books at that point.
Yeah, when some of the guys from Image are appearing on the Bob Newhart vehicle, Bob.
Right.
Yeah, the short-lived attempt to bring comics to the mainstream.
Well,
all of those publishers started at a point, though, when there was no mid-tier.
Valid.
There was Marvel
and
DC,
valid.
And there was nothing below them. So yeah, to be an independent, all you had to be was somebody else. Hey, you're an independent. And they literally forged a tier in the comics industry that was not there at that time. It had disappeared from years before. There used to be this tier, you know. If you remember back in the 60s, Gold King published a huge amount of comics.
Yep.
And they were that second tier at that time. Yeah. And some of them were really good. I mean, they're not all funny animals, though. They were publishing Magnus Robot Fighter, which I thought was really good, solid science fiction. I liked it. You know, they did a lot of different things at that time, and they were that tier. But that tier went away in the 70s.
Yeah, and
that is a very good point, and precisely why we needed you for this, because we don't think about things in quite that way. And you're right that there was a period where it was Marvel, DC, and this sort of lopsided Gilligan's Island and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you had some of these up-and-comers, Image almost engineered its own success, because some of the most popular artists in the industry, at Marvel basically, jumped ship and said, we're doing our own thing. And initially the fans followed, whether the quality was there or not.
Right. And I guess when I'm looking at Image to me is the boy band of comic books. Where when I think in my mind about independent, I think about what we're doing here, or what a garage punk band is making. you're putting your blood, sweat, tears, and money. You're doing what Mirage did, which we went over in our Mirage episode and our Turtles episode. Name your publishing company Mirage, because that's basically what it is. It's two guys with no money left in your living room, you know, giving you the idea that there's this big publishing presence behind you. It's the idea that this is it. You're all in on this thing. That's an independent comic. You're shucking at shows. I've worked as a barker for Independence. You guys have worked directly with Independence. You know, I walked around for Great Big Beef Comics throwing bags of ground beef at people at conventions and yelling, "Buy my beef." Like, that's what those guys do to sell books. You know, the independent, you know, and maybe this is me and my Mark Maron, get off my lawn, old man. You don't get to go on Ellen as an independent comic creator, all right? That, you've made it. You've made it at that point. You know, that's, now I will say this for Liefeld, and I'm saying something in his favor, so somebody press record on something.
I think we're recording this show, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, we are, but I might cut this part. You never know.
Okay.
His line of comics. What was his line of comics with the Awesome Comics?
Awesome.
While he couldn't understand why it wasn't successful. He really did attempt to strike out on his own after that Heroes Reborn debacle, and really make an independent comic book for real. You know, maybe you shouldn't have 25 variant covers for every issue of your comic, but he gave it a shot, and God bless him for that. And you know, you got like Jim Lee in the upper echelons at DC now, and you've got, you know, I don't know what Liefeld's doing, but you know, the guys at Image, I will give them that, they did go out on their own and give it a shot, but it's just just hard for me to call them independent when you have industry.
You just gave the best definition of why they're not really an independent publisher. When one of their co-founding members, Rob Liefeld, has to go independent from them to be independent, they're now part of the thing.
Valid.
You know?
They have now joined the establishment.
Valid. But, yeah. But for Image, I will say this, and I know that we're not talking about the rise of comics at this, you know, rise of the rise, fall, and rise again, but what they're doing right now for independent comics is brilliant. With Fraction and with Kirkman, and giving everybody creator control, giving old Curdy B his ability to make that tooth and nail weird animal fantasy book, and like they're doing it now, but it took them a while to come back around. So
they became their parent, and eventually they learned how to become their grandparent.
That's true.
That's impressive.
All right, so
take a look at the 80s and into the 90s when you began to see, in many ways, what Image and Dark Horse, but especially Image, did, some other successes like Mirage. It literally opened the floodgates for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was working at Diamond at the time, and it seemed like every month there were dozens upon dozens of new publishers that were just coming out of the woodwork.
You can't give enough credit to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle guys for that. There was a time, there was a glut in the industry eventually, but there was a time when that was a tidal wave that you could ride. And I used to make a joke in the early 80s, in the mid 80s, that all you needed to publish a comic was three adjectives and a varmint. So many knockoffs of their book out there. I mean, just Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters was like one that actually stuck around the longest. But there was Prepubescent Samurai Pachyderms.
We did an entire issue based on that very phenomenon.
Yeah. And right. They almost spawned their own little industry. I mean, just, you know, somebody out there was rolling dice and coming up with these random adjectives and sticking an animal on it.
Just like grabbing words out of a bag and then just picking an animal out of Encyclopedia Britannica mammal section or reptile section. But they also, that period also opened the door to the parody comic. One of the more successful and actually quite good parody comics was Nat Rat, The Dark Nat Returns.
That's funny.
Which was literally panel for panel parody of The Dark Knight Returns. And you have this.
A lot of people forget something that I think is very important to note. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and going back even further, Cerebus, two of the most important independent comics to come out, both started as a parody of something else.
Yes,
and
indeed.
A lot of people forget that TMNT started as a parody of Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Oh, yes.
The art style in the first issues was straight up. The origin of the Turtles is like the second part of Daredevil's origin story. The part where Marvel turned their camera to the left, it goes to the right, you get TMNT. The two origins are connected.
That's awesome.
And he fights the foot instead
exactly,
of the hand.
Yes. It's not at all surprising because that was, at that period, the whole idea of ninjas had become so big. I cannot prove this because it would be almost impossible to track down. But I believe the magazine, because back before the internet, we had to go to magazines to find our comic news. Amazing Heroes, I believe, was the one that used to have, not in every issue, but every once in a while, they would have a silly cover. The only other one I can remember was where they had the Alpha Flight team all with this pronounced cowlicks at the front of their heads as Alfalfa Flight.
That's fine.
And some of them were just straight parody of something. But in one particular case, it was just a wonderful jab at the ninja period in X-Men and Daredevil when it became James Clavell's Marvel Comics for a while. Because the ninja had come into vogue. That there was a silly cover they did called simply Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks. And the cover was just a bunch of characters that invoked exactly what you're imagining. And I honestly feel that that predates Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by just enough that they may have been inspired by it, or it might have been, you know, just the zeitgeist with you know, ninjas. I don't know. Yeah. Go. Because
that's worth doing some research on.
Everybody was jumping on ninjas to the point where anyone doing anything tongue in cheek had to include ninjas. In fact, the earliest story arc in another indie publisher that bears mentioning, because they're still around to this day, was born out of the newsletter for a comic shop and the offhand comment of the Tick, exactly, NEC. New England Comic Shop, some offhanded comment about somebody and a bunch of guys playing football, and the one guy that nobody could seem to tackle, it became sort of known as the Tick, and somebody said, hey, that's fun, let's talk to our friend Ben Edlund, he can draw stuff.
And the rest is history.
You know where the first drawing of the Tick was?
I believe was it in a it was either in an issue of the newsletter or it was a convention program.
That might be the first published picture.
Oh,
the first image that he drew was on the end of a comic book box in the warehouse at New England Comics.
Oh, that's great.
He used to decorate the comic boxes in the warehouse, and the handle where your hand goes in on a comic box was the eye slot where the eyes for the character would go.
Nice. That's fantastic. Great.
I did not know that part.
Well, and
I knew something of Tick lore, but not that particular aspect.
And if we're talking about...
The Tick is one of those books that I saw just an ad and knew it was going to be hot and immediately started telling everybody, you need to sign up for this. All I can show you is this one-page ad right now, but this is going to be good.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we did a whole issue on the Tick because it was just such a small phenomenon. But in another issue we did about Omaha the Cat Dancer, I had exactly the same. It was a combination of reading a brief article and seeing an ad in Comics Buyer's Guide.
And to circle back to the independent comics theme of the thing, I saw an ad for this science fiction-looking book one time and fell in love with the art, and I told everybody, this is going to be hot. This is going to be a great story. It was Nexus.
Good one.
I was a huge fan of Nexus before the first issue was even published, and I was already trying to drum up sales for them.
So where
and that was originally by Capital Comics.
So when say drum up sales, Weldon, what do you mean? Because I don't think a lot of people know your history.
At the time, I was working for Buddy Saunders at Lone Star Comics and Science Fiction in Arlington, Texas, when he had one store.
Wow, one store at the time. How many did they, in their prime, how many did they end up with? Do you guys know?
8 stores, I believe, and he may have even had more than that. But I know for a while he had 8 stores plus the mail order, sir.
They were in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They would become the chain.
The chain. That's awesome.
Yeah, they were the one that everyone was, you know, running in fear of. That was it. And the other chain of any note that we had during the 80s at that time was Fantastic Worlds in Fort Worth by Bob Wayne, who I also worked for later.
Good night. There's some memory lane stuff right there.
And it's been having those connections and being a lifelong comic fan that I developed this great love of independent comics and small press stuff. And, you know, before I get too distracted, I got to mention something to be fair. We're talking independent comics, and there's a name that's got to get thrown out there, and that's ElfQuest.
Yes.
That one crossed my mind earlier. And, yes, we cannot leave out the incredible success, ongoing success of the Peonies creation, because that was something even before that was an indie before the indie boom.
Yes.
Right.
They were an indie before indie was cool, and you literally had to have a really good comic shop or go out of your way to find ElfQuest.
Yeah, because you couldn't find it at a grocery store or something. They wouldn't wear it anywhere else.
Well, speaking of comics you couldn't get anywhere else that were independents, one that comes up regularly on this show, and that I know Cole will and both of you will want to talk about, comes from Eclipse. And it comes in the form of Marvel Man.
Oh, yeah.
A.K.A. Miracle.
I can back that one up for you.
You back it
Marvel
up?
Man. I can back that up. Marvel Man was actually a reprint when it started of the British version from Warrior Magazine from the U.K. And I was trying to push that into the hands of anyone that came into my store for a while. And I kept telling them, you're not going to believe how mind-blowingly good this magazine is. And they look at it and go, that's a magazine. It's not a comic book. Okay, so it's bigger than you're used to.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
That
open
the
it up
cover.
And go, oh, it's black and white. Okay, so it's black and white. But this story here, V for Vendetta, it's supposed to be in black and white. It looks awesome in black and white.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I remember, I think I've talked about it on the show before, seeing Warrior Magazine on the racks at Duncanville Bookstore back in the day when Jerry Hoffman would stock that. And when DC picked up V for Vendetta to publish and complete the series, I knew that mask already.
Yeah.
I just didn't know anything about it. And I remember seeing Marvel Man on the covers, or alternately V for Vendetta, or a handful of other different the signature titles that would get the front
laser cover. Eraser and axle press button was in there.
Oh yes, I remember that.
And Marvel Man had kind of a slight sideways spinoff in Zerk, the Silver Sweater of the Spaceways.
That was a really
obscure one. Yeah. It was basically, what if the Silver Surfer was a pig with no head and no tail on half an egg instead of a surfboard?
That would have answered so many of my questions in childhood.
So many questions.
Andy Sweat in space. It was a really strange story, but so much fun.
But again, I guess the most important thing about, you know, the Marvel Man was, you know, who was writing it at the time when it was in Warrior, and who was writing it when it was, you know, when it got picked back up. It was Alan Moore, was it not?
Oh yeah. Yes, well before Watchmen.
Alan Moore was writing Marvel Man and V for Vendetta. And they were both appearing serialized in Warrior magazine at the same time.
So,
and this, of course, again, well before Watchmen. Yes. So to most Americans, Alan Moore was a complete unknown.
Yeah. So, again, independent publication, independent comic as a launch pad for talent is huge.
Oh,
if
yeah.
it's allowed to happen, if it's allowed to incubate. And I think part of the problem we were seeing was, at that point, Marvel and DC were trying to wholesale scoop up as much as they could, you know, and leaving so much of this, you know, like so much detritus on the roadside. Mm-hmm. But you had this brilliant, Gaiman wrote it later. Gaiman, we never get it right. You know,
handpicked by Alan Moore to take over the book. Yes.
Got to. His beard picked him. It wasn't handpicked. It was beard picked. It was the hand came out of his beard.
The mythic beard of Alan Moore.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted
kind of like that guy in the limerick with all the birds in his beard.
Yeah.
Only there's like nightmarish creatures in there.
But, you know, the UK publishers at that time were putting out some phenomenal stuff, and not a lot of American audience were seeing them.
So,
if you want to talk indie, you can't get much more indie than being not Marvel, not DC, and published in another country.
That's true.
That's pretty indie.
Yet somehow getting a foothold in the American market, albeit
a small
very
publisher.
Small.
Called Harrier in England.
I remember Harrier.
They did black and white books, most of which were interesting, but they did a couple that were fantastic. And the couple that they did that were fantastic both happened to be written by the same guy, and his name is Eddie Campbell.
Oh.
And one of them,
we talked about one of these.
One of them was called Dead Face.
We actually talked about Dead Face in the period pieces. Mm-hmm.
And the other one that was just a one-shot that was called By the Time I Get to Wagga Wagga. Mm. And Eddie is actually Australian. And so Wagga Wagga was a reference, I believe, to an Australian city. And it was a story about a character named Alec. And it turns out he had done more of these, and I've followed Alec since then. Fantastic slice of life story, which, by the way, is a genre that pretty much started with the independent comics. There had been some delving into that area, but nobody had really gelled that into a genre until the glory days of the independent comics. But slice of life stories, there's no superpowers usually. There's no science fiction. It's the world outside your door. It's people struggling to keep a job and pay their rent. And it's just tales of ordinary life, but somehow compelling. if it were in TV form, you'd call it a soap opera.
Yeah,
I hadn't really thought about that particular type of comic as being more akin to a soap opera than anything else. A good example of a publisher in that realm, because they basically had, I think, largely creator-owned properties. Fantagraphics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who published all manner of, it was like the home of nearly everything Dan Close ever
touched.
Yeah. Or you had, and then of course, there was one book that Fantagraphics put out that is a very striking indie because a trade paperback thereof, made it onto the silver screen in the Planet of the Apes reboot. Which was, Charles Burns's Black Hole, which I thought, that's the worst thing in the world you want to give to sentient apes as an example of mankind. It's little wonder there's a war for the Planet of the Apes going on. They want to wipe these madmen out.
There's something I kind of want to talk about.
Poor Maurice was just beside himself.
Poor Maurice.
Weeks.
Dr. Zaius was in a spiral. It was... This deserves its own issue, so Cole, we might need to make note of this, but how do we feel about indies versus imprints? Do you feel that the imprint, because it strikes me as one of those, we've got that too. Oh, you've got independent? Well, I mean, kind of independent. You know, we kind of give everybody a little bit more leeway over here at Vertigo. We kind of give everybody a little more leeway over here at Epic.
Yes, Epic was one that was crossing my mind as sort of a non-indie indie.
Yeah, so do those actually fall under the category? What's that?
I said Epic comes the closest to being a true independent. It really felt like a separate division of Marvel. But don't forget, Marvel also did the Max line as an imprint. And you couldn't call that independent in any stretch of the imagination.
No.
Much like the
Dark Horse had their own imprint for a while called Bravura. Is that it?
Yep.
It was supposed to be creator-owned properties. I think Monkey Man and O'Brien was going to start there, and they were getting top names, John Byrne and I forget who all. Unfortunately, it didn't really go anywhere as an imprint for them. So, I think being an imprint is harder than being a true independent.
Okay.
I think because there's still going to be some corporate tendrils, even as much as they attempt to make this sort of a pseudo-indie. DC's Milestone is another example of an imprint that and then there was one Archie Comics, I think DC had picked up briefly, did a separate imprint of some of the old Archie superhero comics.
Impact,
yes. And it was just like it was trying too hard.
I'm about to hurt your brains. I'm about to make you wish that we didn't have a comic show. What about, does anybody remember, since we're talking about imprints, does anybody remember the Razorline imprint from Marvel?
Oh, I do indeed.
The Clive Barker's Razorline imprint from Marvel was it was bad. It was bad. It was, Weldon, do you remember it?
Yep.
That's all I'm getting out of him on Razorline is yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got friends in the industry. All I can say is yep.
I'm just saying, don't give Clive Barker an imprint. That's all I'm saying. Nothing against the creators that created the books. Just don't give Clive Barker his own imprint. That's not the greatest idea.
I will say this, though. The Hellraiser comic book was awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was really good.
That was great.
Yeah.
Another imprint that failed was Marvel's Shadowline.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And they published some really good books. And it's a shame that they didn't do better than they did. But there were some really interesting books in the Shadowline. I think that's where the Knights of Pendragon started.
Oh,
I believe you're right.
So,
but who looks fondly back at Hokum and Hex? I mean, really.
I have them all.
Yeah.
I have them all. I went out of my way to get them all. There was even a TV show based on Saint Center.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, there was. It was loosely based, but it was called Saint Sinner. It was Clive Barker, I think, was the executive producer on the TV show, and they did it. So what happened, guys? What happened to the independence that we love? Something went horribly awry. A lot of them disappeared. A lot of the publishers went the way of the dodo. What went down?
I think
one
Weldon...
of the problems is evolve or die.
Okay.
And a lot of those independent publishers didn't have the means or the way to evolve beyond what they were. The ones that are still around, if you look at them, they've evolved. Cerebus started out as just a tongue-in-cheek parody of Conan the Barbarian, and he very quickly put together a vision, and it's something that almost no other publisher does, of this magnitude at least. He wasn't plotting issues down the road. He had a plan for a 300-issue story arc.
Had read that. Yes, indeed.
Wow.
That is ambitious and, you know, very forward
thinking.
If
you compare an issue of Cerebus from the first 20 to an issue of Cerebus around, I would say, 125 to 150, and then compare that to an issue in the last 25, they are like three completely different books.
Interesting.
That's awesome. Yeah.
But just don't mention Wolveroach around Marvel. It'll get you. Here's another observation on that. I think part of it, Weldon, you hit the biggest, most valid point as to why so many of these went away, especially those that tried to jump in on the mutated animal species bandwagon, and that's all they were doing. Some even tried to do other things as well, but a lot of them were kind of one-trick ponies. A lot of publishers just came out like, oh, here, I'm going to do a parody of something. And they were just sort of like, yeah, great, and they went away. A good example of this was a publisher called Twist and Shout.
Okay.
Who at the time, Topps Publications, and I bring up Topps because I want to get into something else on that note here in a moment. Topps was publishing X-Files comic books, a licensed comic based on the X-Files series. Twist and Shout was publishing a parody, X-Flies, and very shrewdly named themselves Twist and Shout so they would be next in line in previews.
That's funny.
I was working at Diamond, there was a furious publisher who did, or retailer rather, who wasn't paying attention when he was placing his orders, and ordered as many X Flies as he ordered X Files. And that's when I realized, as the running the customer service for Dallas, that Twist and Shout had very cleverly positioned themselves for some accidental sales of their terrible, terrible book.
You know that in the office when that sales member came in, somebody there at Twist and Shout yelled, "We got one!"
That's right. A 40-issue order. This is our biggest seller, X Flies number 2 or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, but where is Twist and Shout today? That's all they published, and it was a flash in the pan. It was, if anybody cared enough. And this was the period that brought us things like Daffy Cadaffy and Spidery Mon, the Jamaican Spider-Man parody. Secret Doors, which was actually a fun book, but the publisher only ever did, like, they were so wrapped up in that in the parody. And, you know, this is a period where Kath and I were, you know, me and Watchmen, I started to develop a Scottish version of Watchmen in hopes of jumping on that bandwagon with some indie publisher. But Topps Comics just happened to, by the very nature of the beast, come up to talk about Twist and Shout. But it brings up, what about the instant indie? That is to say, from the strict definition of not Marvel or DC, so many companies came out of nowhere because there was money already there.
Yeah.
Topps
Comics, Broadway Comics.
Right. They were all trying to jump onto that second tier. They saw that there was a gap where there could be a publisher there, and they were all trying to be that second tier publisher. They weren't trying to be as good as Marvel or DC. Well, they were trying to be as good, but I mean, they knew they weren't going to be Marvel or DC, but they were trying to be right under them. And
exactly.
Yes, a lot of publishers came out of nowhere, threw out a lot of books, and then disappeared.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was the period where the comic had come into the common vernacular. You got a TV show called Bob about a comic creator. You know, people thought they were going to, buying 50 copies of Death of Superman was going to put their kids to college. It's not worth, you know, it's a Sears catalog in like, you know, 1865 hillbilly country. Nowadays, it has that level of value. It's not as coarse as some comics when you're wiping. But, you know, I think that was a period where corporate America kind of glanced over and said, hey, this comic book thing is going on. This is a period where Blockbuster Video, very briefly, was going to carry comics. This was the period of the Starlog store, the
Techno Comics.
You actually beat me to the punch on that because I have a very intimate knowledge of Techno. Techno is probably the most ill-conceived of the entire lot. Because that was some serious corporate cash being grossly,
a lot of money spent there.
Yeah, being misappropriated into a really bad idea, which was if you got famous people to write a treatment and a character development to basically, you know, be the created by and then take their hands off of it.
Yeah.
And you sell comics off names like Mickey Spillane and Leonard Nimoy. I love Leonard.
I think was one of them, wasn't he?
He was indeed. I believe he created Mr. Hero, the pneumatic man.
Yes, he did.
Leonard Nimoy's Primortals.
And Shatner had one too, Tech World.
Yeah, they basically adapted it because his tech novels were already in common parlance at the time, so they sort of adapted that into a comic series. But I think Tech World may have been by somebody other than Techno. But the core idea was if they got famous people to develop characters, then they could just go out and hurl themselves into this market. And I'm always reminded of things I see when new players come into any market. Inevitably, the ones that I kind of cringe at are the ones that say, you know, this is our offering in this X number of $1 billion a year market. It's like, guess what, kids? That number isn't going to change when you arrive. You're just going to dilute that same number.
It's a zero-sum game there.
You're not going to displace the market and raise the bar and more money's going to come in. The money's going to stay about the same. You're just going to get a tiny little piece of it and deflect that from others. But Techno came hoving in, not only imagining they had a marketable comic book concept, but they took it a step further with mostly kiosks and a few storefront stores in malls. And Mrs. Jedi Cole actually managed one during its brief tenure. There was one in the Irving Mall that people would discover it and literally fall to their knees because they had an alternative to Lone Star. Because I'm told, a side note, doing business in Irving, Texas is a bear. The city is founded on the cash grab, and they will take money for every imaginable aspect of your business quite gladly. So a lot of, you know, nobody really wanted to go into that untenable market. But the thing is, Techno was very proud of its own product to the point where they really couldn't understand why nobody was buying their stuff over all the other titles they were forced to buy and sell.
You're not the only publisher that had that problem.
Exactly. And these kiosks were amazing. You know, they had the giant Techno
glove
iron fist. Yeah, the robot fist. They had these monitors constantly playing advertising for, you guessed it, Techno Comics. I don't know how many times I'm like, look, I got to get out of here because I don't have the stomach to listen to Leonard Nimoy talk about the characters from Primortals. Some are liberal, some are conservative, some are dangerous.
In the early 90s, there was an independent publisher who was publishing a moderate amount of books, you know, more than five, less than 10, I think, I would hesitate to call this a monthly basis, but on a supposedly regular schedule. And the head person of this company, which I'm not naming, called my store. And at the time, I was managing Paper Heroes in Killeen, Texas. And he was calling stores across the United States and just made the really coincidentally poorly conceived choice to call me. And he wanted to talk about the book, and I explained to him as politely and kindly as I could that, you know, they're not selling, and I think they're not selling because they don't come out on a regular basis, and that's, you know, probably one of the key reasons right there. And he said, well, how many do you order? And I said, I order enough. I order more than I'm selling. And he said, well, how many do you order? And I said, I'm trying to be polite here, but I mean, if you really want to know the number, I'll tell you, I'm ordering one each. And he said, well, wow, that's the problem. And I said, why is that the problem? And he said, well, if you're only ordering one, you can't sell any more than that. And I said, I'm not selling the one.
It's sitting there.
And he said, well, that's the problem. Nobody wants to buy the last one. If you would order more, you would sell more. And I said, I don't think you understand how retail works. You know, I mean, sometimes I would order two, and when I'm done, I got two. So this is not working out for me, you know. But yeah, that was his solution to the problem, was if I would just order more, his books would magically start selling. Now, if I'm ordering one and it stays on my rack for 2 months, and at the end of that 2 months, I've still got one, that tells me that you're publishing something people don't want to spend money on. That is a real basic reality right there for somebody, because there are plenty of crap-ass comics that I could sell.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And there were plenty of crap-ass comics out there during the indie boom. And it made it difficult, I'm sure, for retailers to know, because nobody wanted to miss the next Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right.
But nobody wanted to
be. Yeah, you don't want to be that guy that's sitting on cases of Captain Carrot and his Amazing Zoom Crew either.
Hey, we agree we were going to talk about that.
Yeah, there's a moratorium.
Yeah. We should have briefed you on that.
He didn't mean to touch a sore spot.
Yeah, I was pretty sure. I mean, who would Yankee Poodle? That still cracks
the
me up.
Per page ratio for that book is very high.
It's dense. It's got a half-life. There's so many puns in there.
Yeah. Oh. Well, what are some other indies that you guys have encountered? Perhaps not necessarily read, but you remember them. I just want to kind of give an honorable mention to some indies that may have gone forgotten and perhaps...
I'm so glad you did that, because there are some that I have loved and adored, and I've been trying to find a way to work them into this conversation. But I want to give a heartfelt, loving shout-out to about three books real quick, if you'll let
Please
me.
Please do. Absolutely. That gives number me time to think
one on my number one on my hit list, Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman.
You want to know an irony? When we were talking about this very issue of the show in advance, I was rattling off some titles that I could think of off the top of my head, and Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman was one of them.
Why is that not a movie? Oh my God, that would be so funny. David Boswell, I think it is. Brilliant. And some of the funniest jokes in there. Just a brilliant series, and managed to tell a cohesive story also. I loved it. And one of my big delights as a fan was getting to meet him at a Dallas show here and getting a sketch. And I said, I want to get a Reed Fleming sketch from you. And he said, okay. And I said, I want something specific though. And he said, okay, what? And I said, it's the funniest line in the whole book. It's my favorite. He said, all right, lay it on me. For those of you listening who don't know, Reed Fleming was a man in his 40s who was completely bald on the top and just had a ring of hair around the sides and back. And the line, the sketch he drew was Reed's face pointing his finger at you with a word balloon screaming, I'm not bald, I get my hair cut this way.
Nice.
That's
awesome.
That's Reed Fleming for you. He was just that, you know, he'd ring the doorbell for a lady. He's a milkman. He delivers milk. Ring the doorbell, lady answers the door, and he says, here's your milk, 68 cents or I piss on your flowers.
That's awesome. So what else, what other ones are in your list of three, your triptych?
Eye of Mongombo was one of the funniest funny animal books. It was about a duck, but it's not technically a funny animal book. It's a funny animal book in the way Howard the Duck is. He was the only animal character in it. It's a normal world of humans. He was an archaeologist, or well, I guess an archaeologist, anthropologist might be a better term, and he was studying these foreign cultures. I think he was in the Amazon. The main character was an absolute insufferable asshole. The worst. And in the first issue, he discovers this forgotten tribe and pisses off the witch doctor, who turns him into a duck.
Uh-huh.
And then that's the rest of the series. He's a duck. There's no going back. And it was brilliant and funny and well-written, fantastic artwork. I really loved it. It only made a handful of issues. But, man, that was indie comics at its best. That's some good stuff. And then superhero indie books. There are some really, really good superhero indie books out there. God, I probably don't have enough time to even list all of those. But, yeah, there have been some really, really good ones. Trying to even center in on one, and there's too many. My mind's overloaded. I'll think of it later. Go.
All right, cool. Andy, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. We'll shoot for it. Paper, rock, scissors. I lost. You go ahead.
I didn't even have a chance.
I know.
Time
I
to
lose
make
fast.
A decision there.
I lose fast.
You do indeed. Well, you were talking about books that are just brilliantly hilarious. Sam and Max, Freelance Police.
Oh yeah.
Just. Because not only were there jokes that were conveyed through the written word, there were also wonderful little jokes that just – I love when someone does some subtle humor in the background.
Yeah.
Like one where he's just, there's something else going on and where the rabbit character had disappeared. And he comes walking back and he's got these two – it just looks like two little animals wrapped around these two sticks. And he's just grinning ear to ear, and there's like steam coming off of it. In the background, you just see this little booth here. It says grilled weasel on a stick. And it's just the combination of that ridiculous notion, seeing it realized in his hand, and how gleeful he is that he scored grilled weasel on a stick for their snacking. It's just a wonderful little joke amid so many.
That's fantastic.
Well, that was a brilliant book, too. Yeah, Freelance Police. What a great concept.
Exactly. Yeah, they're really had no set jurisdiction or anything. You just sort of – they could be brought in at will. And one that Catherine really loved was Usagi Yojimbo.
Oh, yeah.
Which ran for freaking ever.
Yes.
And it was one of those that was one of the other things the Turtles didn't necessarily usher in, but popularized was anthropomorphics, as it would become known.
Mm-hmm.
There was a manga-esque title called Albedo Anthropomorphics that ran for many years. It was just a sci-fi kind of thing that just, all the characters happened to be anthropomorphic animals.
Right.
So live with it. There wasn't like they were supposed to be like, oh, this alien species looks like wolves. No, they're all men. You could plug in ordinary people
right.
into the best anthropomorphic books, and they would work absolutely as well.
Nice.
John Wagner's Hepcat.
Yeah.
Hepcats. Yes, indeed.
I got
a very good story about college students.
No, yeah, it's good. I actually read that one. I got two weird ones, right? Two really kind of odd ones. I've always had a special place in my heart for horror comics. And Steve Niles' 30 Days of Night was one of the made into a movie with Josh Hartnett later, but one of the most horrifying comics I've ever read in my life. And the idea was brilliant, right? You got to see it kind of play out. There were a lot more aspects, as always, in comics than there are in the movie, when they adapt them to the screen. But the concept of Barrow, Alaska, where you get a full 30 days of sunless, 24 hour. Just descend. The vampires descend for a feast on that town. Like, it's the scare. It's one of the creepiest in the art, because it wasn't comic book art. It was definitely like almost like horrific watercolor type art. It was just brilliant. I had never seen anything like it before, and I immediately it was in the vein of your ECs or your creep shows, but then like next level, some next level stuff, and I absolutely loved it. The other one. I said I don't know if I agree that imprints are indies, but when we talk about when we talk about Dreadstar, that
yes
has not only does it travel the cosmos and galaxy to fight for freedom, it's also traveled from Epic to First to Malibu to Image. Like, it has lasting power. And because I read Dreadstar, I went back and picked up one of the Marvel anthology, the Marvel not Masterworks, the Essentials of Starlin's Adam Warlock, which, holy cow, is that amazing. Just, I love Starlin's work. This is one of those things where, he wasn't allowed to do really what he wanted to do under the thumb of the big one of the big two, so decided to do this book, which was everything that an independent comic should be, which is kind of in-your-face commentary on religion and politics mixed with swords and sorcery, cybernetics, magic, just whatever you wanted. There's something for everybody in Dreadstar. There's just something for everybody. I absolutely love it. So I'm putting that on the line for me. Did you think of any of your other
I'll give you that one, Matt. I haven't come up with the one that I'm trying to think of. The quintessential superhero indie comic. But there's a lot of good contenders. Holy Crawler, I guess, would be a good choice. Holy Crawler was a black and white comic that the center of it was a donut shop, hence the name of the book. And it's essentially the donut shop where superheroes hang out between gigs.
Nice.
You know, like you've been doing your patrol, you're wanting to go home, stop for a donut. You know, they'd be sitting in the donut shop talking, something blows up outside, oh crap, something's going on, and then, you know, charge out and deal with it. But it was supposed to be a look behind the scenes of what it's like to be a superhero.
Okay.
Interesting.
Instead of following you on your adventure, they pick up with you after your adventure.
That's cool.
Excellent. That's I like that. Yeah. I'll track that down.
I'm holding in my hand a true independent comic. It's by a guy named Aaron Lindemann, and he's a local here in Dayton, Ohio. And it's called The Fisherman. You can find more at fishermancomic.com, but it's the story of a seaside kind of town, think a Melvillian kind of town, but somehow he manages to kind of fold that into to Mexico. And the fisherman is a lucha, is kind of a down on his luck lucha libre wrestler called the Fisherman that lives in this Melvillian fisherman's town that fights weremice. It's really weird and interesting, and everything that you would ever want, like a funny indie that you picked up at a local con to be. So you just, if you get the opportunity, again, it's called The Fisherman at fishermancomic.com. It's very cool, very nice guy. I got a chance to hang out, like you can do with so many independent comic artists and creators.
Yeah,
by the
so
way
true.
It's so much fun. I had to buy like 3 copies of it just to have on hand, so I've always got one near me if I ever need it.
Well, one other I wanted to, you know, not to get too ampersand heavy, but Milk and Cheese.
Evan Dorkin.
I'm glad you mentioned them. Slave Labor Graphic is one of the finest examples of an indie press out there. They've published some of the best books over the year. Brilliant stuff, all very, very different from each other. Milk and Cheese was a real star. Dairy Products Gone Bad. That's
it's brilliant humor. There was another little indie, I can't even tell you the publisher was, but it was actually collected into a trade paperback as well, called True Swamp. And it basically just follows the adventures of this actual possum living in the swamps.
Guys, I got one. I got to talk about it. Right. Rob Schraub's Scud the Disposable Assassin.
Oh, there's another one that became notable. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Even garnered an action figure from some indie action figure line.
Animated.
To throw back to the concept of Evolve or Die, that started as a parody of the Scud missile attacks going on in the Middle East, and then he turned into longevity, had a little more longevity than people thought he would.
So, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to throw just some names out at random just to, you know, perk up indie fans. We were talking a few days ago, and I could not remember the publisher. It was a Crusade comic, She.
Yes.
Which became such a big deal that She was crossing over with Vampirella and Evangeline. There's even Grifter She from Image. I mean, this was like huge to the point where, you know, the Crusade was like a big deal there for a while. Some others that popped into my head have suddenly escaped me. So if you think of anything, please chime in with it, because all of a sudden...
Another slave labor book that I love dearly was It's Science with Dr. Radium.
Ah, which invokes in my mind for some inexplicable reason, Wolf and Bird, which they were the supernatural attorneys or something like that?
Yeah, Counselors of the Macabre.
That's right, Counselors of the Macabre. I cannot remember the tagline.
Listen, guys, Love and Rockets.
Oh, hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jaime Hernandez really solidified that whole slice of life thing. That story started, the two main brothers, Jaime and Gilberto, they had two different storylines running, but Jaime's stuff started with science fiction and crazy things going on and jet cars and other planets. And very quickly, he realized that the two most popular characters were Hopi and Maggie, and nothing else really mattered. And so all that crazy science fiction stuff just kind of slowly drifted off into the background. And the next thing you know, the girls are living in the barrio and trying to make money to pay the rent. And, you know, we're back to just a regular slice of life book. And it was brilliant and ran forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a wonderful little book I stumbled on called Jar of Fools.
Yeah.
Which, again, very nice little slice of life thing. Eclipse Comics used to be, used to be a force in the industry with titles like Scout. And,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we'd be remiss not to mention the book that our good friend and gracious guest often on the show, Michael Price, The Prowler.
Yes.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
That he worked on that one, and it is, has given us a lot of the history on that book, which is just fascinating stuff. And, was it The Protectors? The other thing we're going to talk about in an upcoming issue titled Return of the Cash Grab that we've talked about in the past was the indies didn't, by and large, have a lot of alternate covers or special covers because they didn't have the dough. But Malibu's The Protectors did.
It's Malibu.
Which was, was the whole, you have the hero's torso in the as the cover image with this gaping, as they say on Simon on Saturday Night Live, a sucking chest wound.
And there's literally a
die-cut hole or a hole that pierces the entire comic from front cover to back cover straight through. There was another indie, I cannot remember what the title was, but it was hilarious when we got these in when we were working at Diamond. They did a promo where they literally took a small gauge rifle and shot stacks of comics.
It
predates the Protectors. That's where they got the idea for that Protector book. That was a Too Much Coffee Man mini comic.
That's right. It was Too Much Coffee Man. Another
by Shannon Wheeler. Yeah, and they, it was called the Gunshot Issue. And he blew a hole through the book and then incorporated it into the artwork on every page.
Yeah, and the thing about it was that when we got those in, there was actually gunpowder in the boxes.
Yeah.
And it was
literally shot everywhere.
There were bits of gunpowder falling out of the pages.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, if you were really super lucky when you were pulling, you might find a shell. God's truth, there were actually shells from this small gauge. And one other that just springs to mind, and I'm going to go ahead and so we're probably way overdue for cutting out.
Probably should wrap it up.
The comic's only other famous Green Rabbit, Bucky O'Hare.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Was, that was a good one. Is it Art Adams? Is that right?
Michael Golden.
Michael Golden, that's right. He was one of the guys that I loved.
That was Michael Golden. That was good stuff. When you were talking about the Protectors cover, I thought you were going to talk about the Ferret, who got his own miniseries.
Yes.
And they did a special die-cut cover for him. And the gimmick was that the cover is the profile of his face. And they die-cut it along his face edge. But to make the book shape, he's got a really square head. That's the weirdest. Yeah, that's the weirdest, you know, special cover issue thing I've ever seen, was that die cut head issue.
Right on. Yeah, no, but we should wrap it up. We've gone a little long, so we should probably lock it down. So,
well, I think as Weldon said, you could do, you know, days upon days of these there's just no shortage of things we could talk about.
Right. We could go on about
the one publisher I haven't mentioned. The one publisher I haven't mentioned yet predates alternative comics as we know them, and that's Power Comics from the 60s. And I just wanted to give them a shout out because they are amazing comics.
There you go. There you go.
Interesting. And I guess one other thing I want to point out is on the imprint is when you get a former indie who then makes an imprint.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that would be Dark Horse's Comics Greatest World.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which was another just bad ideas.
They tried so hard. They tried so very hard.
They wanted to get there. They just couldn't quite make it happen. All right, Cole.
The closest they got was Barbed Wire, and Matt got a movie.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true.
Did it, though. Cole, why don't you Weldon, thank you again, man. It's always it's always a pleasure to have you on here, especially you just it's Count Esoterica now, so that's
Count
your,
Esoterica,
that's your new name. You are a pleasure. You are a gentleman and a scholar, and we are blessed to have you grace us with your presence. And I that isn't me trying to give you a big head. That's the real of the situation.
This is awesome.
I'll give you a kiss.
That's all it took. Awesome.
Yeah, this is us coming off of an amazing arc that you were part of.
Yes.
That all five issues had incredible guests who brought so much, oftentimes brought more to the table than they anticipated they were going to bring. And so with that, we're going to say bid you a farewell with the letting you know that we're coming to you from the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. We'll be back next week with a special issue I'm looking forward to with our special guest, Mrs. Jedi Cole, where we the title is The Writing on the Wall. And I think if you know me, you know exactly where we're headed with that one. And not that I haven't talked for like 16 hours on the subject all told in my podcasting career. But you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. Look for tweets coming soon. A lot of big announcements, a lot of fun stuff coming up on the JCU at the Jedi Cole U. Look for convention appearances of the Rancor Pit and the Rancor Pit Roadshow. You can check out Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. Every convention in the state of Texas all year long, because you can't go if you don't know. And look for the Rancor Pit Live on DallasOnAir.com, the first and third Sundays of every month. Coming up on the 16th, I'll be braving my wedding anniversary by producing a show on the same day with the unmountable Bobby Blakey as my guest, where we say, if you can't stand the heat, and we talk about the hot spots in the Star Wars universe. And, of course, you look for the YouTube channel for the Rancor Pit for all but one lost episode of the show that Eddie Medina has very carefully preserved for our benefit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that does it. Buy, collect, and enjoy your comics, especially if they're indies, because the thing is, there are so many brilliant comics that you've never heard of out there that just people putting in the work to make this for you guys. Go find them. You can find them in your local comic book shops. You can find them, you know, at your local conventions.
Quarter bins.
Go to conventions. Meet the people who make them. They come to see you and talk to you and tell you why they made their book and how they made their book. Go talk to them. It's such a unique experience. And again, thank you, Weldon, for coming on the show once again. And
absolutely.
Bye. And yeah, join us next week when we talk about the writing on the wall. Thank you, everybody. Good night. Say good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.